Well, man, I'm grateful for this group for so many reasons. Among them, it helps me to distinguish one day from the other in a series of days that feels very similar. I imagine my week is like a lot of yours. There are some pleasant things about it. I like my house. I like the people who are here. And I like taking walks and having more time with my dog and these sorts of things. But there are moments where I just get overwhelmed at the enormity of everything that's going on in this world right now, its potential impacts, stretching out into the future at so many different levels of society. And it has just forced me into dependence and prayer and study and with that deep, urgent sense of need. And even for that, I can be grateful. So I'm hoping that with that sort of appetite, you men are here this morning, and I'm hoping that there's a blessing in this for you as there was for me in the preparation. The passage this morning is Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9, which reads, "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you." 2 weeks ago, I talked here about Paul's prescription for peace in Philippians 4, 4 through 7. Albeit I spoke with a lot higher production value from the sanctuary of the church where we recorded that one. But in that passage, Paul instructed his readers to rejoice in the Lord and to bring all of their anxieties to God in prayer. His promise was that such rejoicing in prayer would result in the peace of God guarding their hearts and minds. Today's passage contains another prescription with a similar promise. Paul calls his readers to exercise discipline in their thought life and in their actions with the promised result that the God of peace will be with them. In classical Greek, the word irene meant the absence of war. But when Jewish writers of the New Testament used that term that we translate peace, it was inextricably linked with the Jewish concept of shalom. It was a sense of well-being, of reconciliation, of right relationship, and of wholeness. In this time of global upheaval, when no one is untouched by this COVID-19 virus, these events, either by the virus itself or by the restrictions and the economic fallout from the government's response to the virus, we all share an increased longing for that peace, shalom. Well, Paul provides us with two lists in the verses that we're looking at today. The first identifies eight qualities that should characterize the things that we're thinking about as Christians. The second list identifies the things that we should be putting into practice in our walk as Christians. Well, the inputs from the first list are going to influence the outputs in that second list. Paul's list of the things that we should think about begins with whatever is true. Truth, in its bluntly literal sense, pertains to what actually occurs. Its antonym is false. We tend to equate the word truth with the word fact. We live in an age of abundant information, and there are a whole lot of facts flying around. But most of us recognize that accurate facts can be manipulated to support differing conclusions. For example, a writer who's seeking to paint the current White House administration in a negative light will focus on the gross number of infections in our country, but the per capita rates of COVID-19 testing. A reporter who's supportive of the current administration will do exactly the opposite. Each of those writers wants their readers to reach a different conclusion about what's going on, to think different things about what's going on, so they present facts differently. We all want to think that we have the ability to discern the truth amidst the noise. But let's be honest with ourselves. We all have a preferred narrative, and we're more inclined to believe presentations of fact that support our preferred narrative. Sociologists call this confirmation bias, and it's almost impossible to get rid of that in ourselves. When the COVID-19 crisis was just beginning, a lot of people sent me a video and posted on social media a video of this medical reporter who went on an angry rant about the overreaction to the virus. This video was everywhere. Among other things, this gentleman said that the people reporting on the virus had no idea what they were talking about. It was a mild virus, no worse than the flu. Well, frankly, his report suited my narrative. I wanted him to be right. I didn't want to cancel trips. I didn't want to lose business. I didn't want to suffer life disruption because of an overreaction to a virus that at that time mostly seemed to be affecting people on the other side of the world, a few people in Washington. I was skeptical because I'd heard similar alarms about the bird flu and the swine flu. Just feels like we've had these alarms that went off almost like snow day warnings in Atlanta in January in the past that never amounted to anything. Well, that video that I had seen and placed some stock in, it hasn't aged well. But because it supported my preferred narrative, I continued to shape my opinions even after other data started coming in. I was pretty late to the party in taking this thing seriously. And so stuff I said a month ago hasn't aged terribly well. In my defense, nothing anyone was saying a month ago has aged terribly well. But the appropriate response to these changing narratives is not defensiveness. The appropriate response is humility. But in light of these competing narratives, the frustrating unreliability of our own news media, and the many conspiracy theories that make their way to my inbox from these people who really know what's going on, I found myself reflecting on the dialogue between Jesus and Pontius Pilate just before Christ's crucifixion. It's recorded in the 18th chapter of John, and it's particularly appropriate for us to consider during this Passion Week. I'll read it. "Therefore, Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus to him. 'Are you the king of the Jews?' Jesus answered, 'Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?' Pilate answered, 'I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?' Jesus answered, 'My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed. My kingdom is not of this realm.' Therefore, Pilate said to him, 'So you are a king.' Jesus answered, 'You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice.' Pilate said to him, 'What is truth?'" Pilate's question sounds strikingly postmodern. What is truth? Pilate said this because he knew that the Jewish leaders were using an accurate fact to tell a bigger lie. Jesus had claimed to be a king, but both Pilate and the Jewish leaders knew that Jesus was talking about a kingdom that was not of this world. The only one speaking real truth in this encounter was Jesus, who said, "I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who's of the truth hears my voice." This truth that Jesus was speaking is what Francis Schaeffer, the philosopher from the 60s and 70s, referred to as true truth. True truth is factually true, and we must never concede that true truth is anything other than factually true. But true truth is far more significant than mere fact. True truth is eternally and permanently true, transcendently true, and completely true, irrespective of context. True truth is the truth that brings about transformation in men. When Paul exhorts us to think about what is true, is he calling us to spend 6 hours a day plowing through the internet in an effort to get to the real facts underlying this global upheaval? I don't think so. And if he were, then his promise of peace would be pretty dubious, because those efforts tend to result in anger and paranoia and fear rather than peace. I believe Paul was calling us to think about true truth, the truth to which Jesus testified. Everyone who is of that truth hears God's voice as it calls to us in these times that are fat with facts, but thin with truth. To be clear, I am not calling you to be gullible or ignorant. In fact, the church suffers from too much gullibility when it comes to questionable sources of information and too much ignorance with respect to things occurring in the world. As Christians, we need to be responsible in both our receipt and our distribution of information. We need to exercise discernment. We need to be aware of our own biases and to seek to confirm rather than merely disseminate stories that seem to support our preferred narrative. Personally, what I do is consult several different news sources a day, each of which I know has a particular bias. I triangulate among those different sources and note where stories overlap and where themes emerge even among sources that come from different ideological positions. If you don't know your sources bias, then I'll quote Paul Newman. If you're playing a poker game and you look around the table and can't tell who the sucker is, it's you. They all have bias. I'm not asking you to avoid the news. To do so in today's environment would be irresponsible. But to quote Paracelsus, the poison is in the dose. So what I do exhort you to do is avoid being consumed by the news of the day. Instead, fill your mind daily with true truth, the things that will be relevant in a year and in a decade and for eternity. Paul's list of the things that we should think about goes on to include whatever is honorable. The word could also be translated noble. It refers to things that are worthy of respect and honor. Paul used the word elsewhere when he challenged church leaders to be honorable. Ask yourself, do you actually devote any bandwidth to thinking about what is honorable? Our popular culture certainly doesn't, because honor seems kitschy and naive in a culture that's characterized primarily by cynicism. That's what popular culture appreciates. And yet, it is edifying to think about what is honorable. To reflect on honorable men and women and noble deeds encourages imitation. We are in need of honorable men. You can find examples of nobility in the news if you are really looking for it, and you can also find great examples of nobility when you read biographies of honorable people. We are to think about whatever is just, which could also be translated righteous. Things that are righteous are in conformance to God's standards. They are right, fair, and good. Right, for Paul, is always defined by God and his characters, not defined by merely human understanding of what is right or just. It's defined by God and his relationships with his people. To discern what is righteous requires that we know God's word, which defines righteousness for us. So meditate on what is righteous instead of dwelling on what is wicked, even though there is no shortage of wickedness to attract our attention. Even from a Christian perspective, we can be too consumed in reflecting about things that are wicked, even if it's in a negative sense. Dwell instead on what is righteous, what is good. And when Paul says think here for all of these things, he doesn't mean merely to keep in mind. It's rather reflect upon and then allow these things to shape your conduct. So Paul doesn't mean that we should simply catalog things that are righteous here. Instead, we should think about what is righteous so that we will behave righteously. He goes on, we are to think about whatever is pure. Pure translates a word meaning holy in relation to God. It includes the idea of innocence and chastity, something that has not been tainted by evil. Think of all the information that you consume. How much of it is truly pure? We will unavoidably encounter impurities in our lives, mostly because we have to live with our impure selves. But choose to spend time reflecting on what is holy, innocent, and untainted, and it will begin to purify you. In Paul's list, he moves from traits that are primarily religious to two concepts that are taken straight from Hellenism. Hellenism refers to the culture, philosophy, and art of ancient Greece. The words translated lovely and commendable here are only found here in the New Testament. Combined, they carry the idea of objective beauty that elicits expressions of praise. Scholars are in general agreement that Paul's use of these words is an intentional departure from things that are narrowly religious. They could apply to the works of Beethoven, paintings of Renoir, the writings of Shakespeare. As I was writing this talk, I was sitting on my deck on an exquisite Saturday afternoon that I hope many of you enjoyed. The trees displayed the soft greens of early spring, and my azaleas and dogwoods are in full bloom. Dozens of birds were singing from different corners of the yard in this spontaneous chorus. To simply exist in that environment with eyes open elevates my soul. It was lovely. I think there are two primary obstacles that prevent Christians from embracing things in this world that are lovely and commendable, but are not overtly religious. First, we fear that such an embrace renders us somehow less spiritual. We feel like we should only be thinking about specifically Christian things. Second, we worry about that our study of such things is too trivial in light of the serious and suffering that surrounds us. Well, with respect to the first obstacle, I find it liberating that Paul not only acknowledges the beauty in things that are not overtly spiritual, but he encourages us to think about such things. Historically, the Christian faith has celebrated such beauty in itself, been a great engine for creative expression. I can safely speak in front of a modern evangelical audience of Shakespeare, of Beethoven, of Renoir, but I hesitate to identify current forms of art that I find beautiful or humorous or moving because I'm afraid of offending somebody. We need to get over this. I need to get over this. These words, lovely and commendable, remind us that common grace, this grace is experienced by believers and non-believers in God's created earth, that common grace is a New Testament reality, both in times past and today. There are many examples of beauty in our secular culture, and we Christians should not be so hesitant to celebrate them. If nothing else, men, the celebration of beauty that's not just specifically religious gives us common ground with the non-believer from which we can build a dialogue about the true truth that underlies all beauty. With respect to the second obstacle, this notion that the pursuit of beauty is a needless excess in serious times, I note that our God filled this world with a needless excess of beauty. I'm a fan of our national parks, and as I sit in those places of wonder, I'm in awe at the extravagance of a God who lavished those things on us. I also observe that if man were to wait for moments when the pursuit of beauty seems urgent, important, those moments would never arrive. In 1940, C.S. Lewis gave a talk to a group of young men, most of whom were soon to be called up to fight in the Second World War. The talk is called Learning in the Time of War. You can find it in his book, The Weight of Glory. In that talk, Lewis said, "As university students, you will be expected to make yourselves into philosophers, scientists, scholars, critics, or historians. And at first sight, this seems to be an odd thing to do during a great war. Is it not like fiddling while Rome burns? Every Christian must ask himself, how is it right or even psychologically possible for creatures who are every moment advancing either to heaven or to hell to spend any fraction of the little time allowed them on this world to trivialities as literature or art or mathematics or biology? For this reason, I think it is important to see the present calamity in true perspective. The war creates no absolutely new situation. It merely aggravates the permanent human situation so that we can no longer ignore it. Human life has always been lived on the edge of a precipice. Human culture has always had to exist under the shadow of something infinitely more important than itself. If men had postponed the search for knowledge and beauty until they were secure, the search would never have begun." I'm going to show you guys my favorite picture from the Second World War. This is a picture of men who were perusing books in England during the Battle of Britain after bombing. These men, they could have cowered, they could have retreated, they could have temporarily forsaken their pursuit of knowledge and beauty, but in the midst of the carnage, they pressed on. I don't see that as frivolous. I see it as noble. We do not have to succumb, even in these trying times, to the ugliness of our trials. I think I have you back. So once you've consumed an appropriate amount of news for the day, which I do think we all need to do, but there's an appropriate amount. Step away from your computers and instead read a great novel, or maybe write one. Watch a well-reviewed movie that stretches you, or go outside and observe the beauty that God put into this world. When you talk with other men during your Zoom meetings or from across the street while you're walking your dog, look for opportunities to talk about something other than the events of the day. It's not just me telling you to do this, it's Paul. He goes on, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about such things. Look for what is excellent around you and use that as an opportunity to praise God. Do you encounter a person who's excellent in their work? Do you read of a helpful discovery by one of the scientists working on a vaccine? Do you hear of an act of sacrifice intended to help others during the crisis? Then praise God that he has put such skill and nobility in men. In verse 9, Paul moves from the thinking to the doing. As he did in chapter 3, verse 17, which we've talked about previously, he encourages the Philippians to imitate him. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things. I addressed some of the challenges of that teaching a few weeks ago because it seems arrogant for a person to say, well, imitate me. I'm not going to belabor those points here, but for those of you who haven't heard that earlier talk, Paul isn't encouraging intimidation because he thinks of himself as morally perfect. He makes that abundantly clear in his other writings. But what he believes is that, but he believes what he has preached to them, and he believes it so thoroughly that he has diligently sought to model it for them. Remember that these people lived in a time before the church fathers had compiled the New Testament. So what they had was the occasional letter from Paul and the example that Paul and the other apostles lived in front of them. The apostles took their role as role models very seriously, and so should we. My nugget this morning is a bit distinct because I don't think I've ever used a negative command as a nugget, but I'm going to do that this morning. Do not let your day consist of several hours of news consumption followed by a couple hours of crappy TV and then going to bed. Such a day will not produce peace. Your brain will atrophy. You'll experience listlessness and dissatisfaction, and your testimony will suffer. Instead, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. This will produce peace. That's the promise. It will also honor God, elevate your state of mind, and give you a testimony worthy of imitation. Now, I have a specific recommendation that I've made before, but I'm going to make again with a promise. My favorite novel is A Soldier of the Great War by Mark Halperin. I'm sharing with you now an article by David Powelson, who many of you may remember. He died recently, but he was a Christian counselor and thinker, and he contributed to the Gospel Coalition, and he wrote this article a few years ago entitled A Novel Every Christian Should Consider Reading. There's a picture of the cover of the book. And he said of it in this article, he'd read the book four or five times before he wrote this review, and he identified this theme in the book. God is true. He is good. He is beautiful. Sin corrupts all three. Grace redeems all three. Now, Mark Halperin's Jewish, and I think he's a secular Jew. It's not a Christian book, and yet it has these truths in it, this beauty in it. Andy Crouch, who's an author, Christian author, and the former editor of Christianity Today, wrote a review of the same book and said, "When I finished the book, I sat in silence for half an hour. I thought later, and I'm still tempted to think, that I would never fully trust any pastor who had not read it." So Zach and Mike and TJ, you know, that's instruction to you. He goes on, "There's just too much tragedy and terror as well as beauty and grace and help in store for anyone entrusted with other souls to treat it carelessly." So if you have the ambition to take on the somewhat demanding 800-page novel, I give you this promise. When the clouds of this present crisis pass, all of you who read and appreciate it are invited to gather at my home on my dime. That's assuming I survive this thing somewhat whole. And we can celebrate God's deliverance and his eternal beauty together at an epic book club. So I look forward to that day. So that is my nugget. Read something other than the news. Celebrate the beauty that still surrounds us, even in these times of trial, and seek to fill your mind with things that lift up and edify. Think about true truth. And with that, we can go to the tables.